Take ORFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and streaming of primo local content. Download the accessmedia.nz app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This program was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
And welcome to a show. Tonight we're actually joined by Scott Willis, who's the manager of the Blueskin Resilience Trust in Blueskin Bay, which is this beautiful bay that's just to the north of Dunedin, just up the coast. And it's a beautiful community out there. And it's a pretty amazing place. And we'll talk to Scott about all the amazing things him and the community trust have been doing out there. And some amazing stuff going on. So, Sam, did you have anything to talk to us about this week?
Oh, you want a thought of the week? I could make up a thought of the week.
You could do.
I've been working on doctorateness. That sounds fun, doesn't it?
It does.
Doctorateness in professional practice. So the doctorate at the Polytech, the Doctor of Professional Practice, is what's referred to as a third-generation professional doctorate. So an ordinary doctorate is a PhD, that's the one that most people are familiar with. A first-generation professional doctorate is like a specialised PhD in the field, like it might be ophthalmology is a common one. A second generation is where you take that learning and do that in the workplace, but it's a research that's done in the workplace. The third generation takes a different approach, whereas those first two generations are basically tailored versions of a PhD. A third generation one says, okay, it's all about practice. It's all about what does practice mean? The messiness of practice, the wickedness of practice problems. And what does it mean to do that? And it's all about self-determination. So the learners are determining their own pathway. We don't pretend to be experts in their field. They are the experts in their field. So we wouldn't try and say to Scott, we know more about managing a resilient community than you do. You've got to learn from us. We would be helping him to make that an even better place through the approaches to learning, not through the content. And one of the things that I'm working on at the moment is how do we prove that? What's the a traditional thesis, which probably all of us here have written in some form. I think we all have.
Yeah, we have.
It's a book that did anyone read it?
No.
It goes up on a shelf, and you might hope that someone's going to read it eventually, but as a general rule, they don't. And we think that's a bit silly. Why are we doing that? So we've got a practitioner thesis, which we've got purposefully undefined. And so it's up to the learners to say, this is my claim, and this is how I want to prove it.
And are we putting any structure around that? Are you saying, look, you need a literature review?
Nope. So it would be, given that the argument that they are making, the thesis doesn't mean a book. A thesis means a defensible argument. But people think it means a book because it kind of has, over the centuries, has turned into the expectation of a book. The argument has to be defensible. That's the thing that you're doing. So it's got to be a contribution. In our case, to practice and to changing practice and to outcomes. And it needs to be done in context. So usually that means in the context of all the literature that's been written before. In our case, we say, yes, that, but also the context of practice, because almost all of the questions that people are doing come from practice rather than from academic research. And quite often it's we've got this problem in practice. Nobody wants to build our windmill, or nobody wants to let us build our windmill. There's not good science on that. Well, let's work on solving that problem. You can see I'm thinking about that. So yes, there will be some literature because you want to do it in context because other people have solved similar sorts of problems and you want to be, you know, you're not reinventing the wheel every time. But our premise is that the people, say, this is the claim I want to be making. This is the claim I want to be making. This is the kind of story I want to be telling. This is the form that I want to tell that story in. This is why that form's a good idea. So that this particular form might be really good for to supporting the fact that my research is being done with lots of other people, so it's collaborative. Or as a real challenge, it's got collective ways of knowing, particularly if it's got indigenous knowledge in it. It's not that I know this stuff. We know this stuff. The community might know this stuff. How do you squish that into a traditional book? Might not work. And then the last thing is, and how is that form supporting the claim that I want to be making? So how is it enabling me to make the claim of doctorateness? And how does it allow the institution to scrutinize that claim? So rather than us saying, here is a thing, as you said, it's got to have a literature review, it's got to have a methods, it probably might end up having some of those things, but also it might not. One of the things we talked about today, which is why I thought this might be interesting, is we talked about the possibility of somebody saying, okay, let's say that they're going to do a fisheries management system in a Matarangi Māori, Kaupapa Māori type way. And so their evidence, their artifact might be the thing that they've written, the strategy document, and that's surrounded by a whole lot of indigenous knowledge, which might not be appropriate for them to write it down, because it's not just knowing that stuff, it's how you know it. You've known it for 20 years, you've been out, you know, that working with the community for all that time. That's quite different from saying, well, I know that this fish is called this species and this is called this and this. You know, it's not that kind of knowledge. It's much more about community practice. So here's our hypothesis. Could you, for example, present the strategy? The examiners look at that strategy, but also go and have a hui with the people from that hapu or from that marae and say, well, this is what we need to be looking for in terms of doctorateness, this level of expertise that may or may not line up with some Maori concepts. Let's talk that out. Let's talk that through. So could we have community-based assessment? Not assessment of communities, the community doing the assessment in higher education. There's my thought for the week, because that's what I'm thinking about.
And that's really amazing, because it kind of reminds me of, you know, that kind of statecraft concept of, you know, there's local knowledge, which has meaning for local people, but doesn't have meaning for the state at the state level. And then there's like state knowledge, which doesn't necessarily have meaning at the local level. And a classic example was like, people saying, oh, I've got a 2-cow farm or a 10-cow farm. Well, the state's not interested in how many cows you have. It's interested in how much land you have. How many hectares of land do you have? You know, and how do I understand, you know, so the state kind of interprets things, the state's the university, maybe, tries to understand things in ways it conceives, how it conceives of the world. But then, you know, from the person at the end, you know, trying to do their PhD, they have another way of looking at the world. And how do you marry those two concepts? And one of the problems with sustainability is around that. You know, how do you marry state level, or, you know, kind of, you know, those high level goals with local actions? And gives it local meaning. That's the
holy grail of sustainability, is somebody actually figuring out what think global, act local actually means in practice.
Yeah, and it just sounds like you're doing it with a PhD. That's fascinating. That's
really so amazing. Someone who is
doing single
is working on thinking globally and acting locally.
So Steve, that's brilliant. How Where were you born? Were you born here in Dunedin, or where were you brought up?
Yeah, I was born in Dunedin. I began my journey in Roxburgh.
Where's Roxburgh?
Roxburgh's in central Otago, and my mother decided that I wasn't going to come along in a hurry. So a day later, I arrived in Dunedin Hospital back in the day, back in 1968. Here we go. 1969.
And what did you want to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be many things, and it depends at which age. I think young, I wanted to be an astronaut. Who didn't? And I think, and it was in my late teen years, I thought I could be an architect. I quite like the idea of building and creation and looking at things differently. Became neither.
So what did you do?
Well, I think I bummed around for a while. I went to university for a couple of years, and I passed my first year. I was so amazed, I went back for a second year.
Whoa.
And
what were you studying?
Partying, mainly. And that paid off. In the second year, I managed to pass only one paper, and at that point I did what I'd intended to do the previous year and went travelling. But university did call, and I came back a few years later and finished off a degree. And then with a little bit more of a serious approach, and did very well because I gained a bit of maturity.
And what was the degree in?
Is this
some sort of shameful fact that we're trying to? What degree did you get?
I have a degree or a master's in social anthropology. Actually, the degree was in anthropology, and then I followed up with a master's looking at neo-peasantry. So my thesis, a typical written thesis, is called "The Chestnut Economy," and it looks at the growth of neo-peasantry post 1968 as a civic and social movement in the south of France.
Oh wow!
Involved.
What does it mean?
The chestnut economy?
No. The neo-peasantry.
Neo-peasantry. So neo-peasantry is not peasants. Peasants have virtually been wiped out, but it's a conscious choice to adopt simpler ways of life and to practice a circular economy within a modern state.
Could you hear about similar words, similar phrases used to describe the effect of uberization, the lowering of the workers, that don't have the support, and I think that they're owning companies, but really that's just because the actual company is working at it. But it's not that.
No, not at all. No, and actually, when you're talking about practice before, neo-peasantry, if you like, I don't want to use any technical terms, but one of the things that we talked about was praxis, which is, you know, an idea put into practice. So praxis is really important because it's learning how to dig, how to milk goats, how to survive a winter by growing your own food and storing it, and knowing that you don't have to, but choosing to do so because you have other values. So that's what the neo-peasantry is about, or was about, and it was a return to the earth movement from the 1968 Cultural Revolution in France. A really interesting space to re-inhabit what had been ghost villages and ghost hamlets in the south. They'd been abandoned when Napoleon came through and created roads.
So why did you call it the chestnut economy? What was...
Well, it was in the Cévennes. The Cévennes at the bottom of the Massif Central, central massif, and above Montpellier, and it's a really rough mountainous zone, a bit like the West Coast, only with people in it and villages all through it. And chestnuts were the feculent, feculent, the crop to feed everyone. What's the word? What's a starch? Thank you, right. Starch. So chestnuts were the starch that provided flour. You could roast them. The animals could eat them. It provided wood that you could build with immediately. It was the thing that you could do everything with. It provided sustenance.
So beyond the technicalities of that particular subject area you're working on, would you recommend social anthropology?
Well, I mean, it
was in the right. You're in the right building. Just two floors too low.
No, social anthropology really should be the base of every part of education, because it is teaching you about humanity and the diversity of humanity and how what curious creatures we are.
It's not geography, though.
Geography is just a little bit too stark. So anthropology has people in it. That's important.
I think you find the human geography has got people in it too. And we were in the same building at the same time. So you went from there and then what?
So I came back. We came back to New Zealand and... Oh, we went away again. We went away again and travelled and lived in France. But then we had a baby on the way and decided we would come home.
Sorry, this went from you to we? Who's the we?
Yes, so...
Sorry, I'm a trained interrogator. No, I mean interviewer.
Fair enough.
We've got a big light, if you like.
Well, I think, you know, in 1991, partway through, in between university and travelling, I met my wife, Jenna Packer, and she decided that she wanted to go travelling. Just after we met, she was going travelling anyway and went separately over to Europe to stay with an aunt somewhere in Scandinavia, and I went separately to Australia and then travelled through Asia. And you know what happens when you're far apart from somebody that you really care for? And I called her up out of a payphone somewhere in Malaysia and offered to meet her in India, midway. And she wasn't that keen. I was really surprised. And I thought, So I, you know, it's hard to, you can't see someone's eyes, and you couldn't do Skype in those days. So a phone call, I ran out of coins. So I got a ticket to Amsterdam and went and met her over there, decided that she wasn't going to come and meet me halfway. I better go.
And it worked.
It worked. So we went back.
So, and then you came back.
And then we came back. Yeah. And then we went again. And then we came back. And then we went again.
So how did you end up in Waitati?
When we came back to New Zealand, we looked around and we had moved back from France, from the south of France, where we'd lived in what I now recognise to be a quite alternative community. And we were looking for a place that could echo those values in New Zealand. And we looked around and we targeted a number of areas, Coromandel, Takaka. Dunedin wasn't top of our list, but we had family in Dunedin, and we came back to visit family and happened to visit Blueskin Bay and loved it. And we decided that we would rent a house there for a year, and that year became 20 years. So it was a reasonably quick love affair.
Oh, wow.
And you didn't have to go to Amsterdam. What was it that appealed?
I think it was Mushroom Magazine, the friendliness of people and the beautiful landscapes. At the time, it was also the willingness of people to get stuck in, do things and make things happen. So that was the initial attraction to Blueskin Bay.
So I'll describe you as a community organiser. I'm about to do that.
That's fine.
So when did you become that? 10 seconds ago, apparently. When did you sort of start taking that sort of role?
It was interesting. I was at university doing, as an assistant lecturer, teaching the global politics of food. It was a great paper, by the way, and now in sociology, and decided that some of the volunteer work I was doing in the community was pretty important. And we had an opportunity to start something new, to start work on some substantial climate action. So I took a jump from lecturing at the university at a reasonable wage to minimum wage, part-time work, but doing something I was passionate about, and began work. We created the Blueskin Resilient Communities Trust, and I became its manager. First its coordinator, and then its manager, way back in 2008.
So how did that get established, and how did you fund it? So can we talk a little bit about that? Just the practical processes around that.
It's not something I'd recommend anyone doing. It's jumping into the deep end. The first thing we did was find people who we thought had some experience in setting up a charity or in running a community organisation. That's not always evident, and it threw us some curly ones later on, but we got people to sign a document and set up a document for a trust that was a legal document and enabled the trust to be established. And then we needed some money, and we got core funding from the Otago Community Trust at the time, which provided an initial 6 months' worth of employment, minimum wage, part-time. Within that time, we had managed to create enough momentum to secure a contract from ICA to deliver what was called at the time the Waitati Insulation Retrofit Program. And that ended up delivering over $780,000 worth of insulation retrofits within 4 months to the Blueskin area, up to Hampden and out to Mosgiel. And that was a contract we secured, but we ran as a subcontractor to the Otago Regional Council. And that really was the way we kicked things off.
So,
what was the vision? Because the vision wasn't to be installing insulation or, more latterly, running power systems and things. The vision was to do what?
We held a community meeting in 2006. We had Sue Kedgley as a speaker, and that was one of the volunteer activities I did to help energize our community and get our community thinking about the big issues. And I'd happened to have Sue down as a guest lecturer in a course I was teaching. Sue Kedgley was a Green MP, and she was able to talk about energy and food. So we held a community workshop with Sue Kedgley as the keynote, and then sat around and did some visioning for what did we think society would be like 10 years hence, 20 years hence. And out of that came a suite of ideas and a suite of concerns, and that provided the momentum for the first actions that were still volunteer actions. In 2006, we started up the Waitati Edible Gardeners Group, or the Wedgies. Got a really, really uncomfortable initiation. And then we started up a year later the Waitati Energy Project, which became the Blueskin Energy Project. Both of those were volunteer initiatives, but they had gained so much momentum that we decided to set up the trust, and after that came the retrofit program. So it came out of the concern that climate change wasn't being addressed, that we were hitting peak resources, and as a consequence of these two facts, we would be experiencing economic instability and rough tides, rough waters. Therefore, it was important that community take things in hand, and that was our purpose.
Why is community the level of intervention that you're working at?
I'm the most powerful when I can make decisions for myself. I lose power when as part of a family, there's more of a consensus. I lose a little bit more power in my neighbourhood and in my community, a little bit less, and outwards it goes. So the wider the circle of community you go, the less influence you have to make change happen. Community to me is a good scale, 1,000 people plus, to try to affect good change. We need to rebuild a sense of collectivity and a sense of collective power. And doing that as an individual, I could go and live in a cave. I could live in a cave and be really low emission and not change a damn thing. So by working in the community and by demonstrating what we can do when we pull together, we can hopefully shift things at a different scale. We can provide influence to government and to other state actors through showing Flaxroots solutions and the impact of them on people and on community.
Were you inspired by these French movements, the neo-peasants? Was that something that was an inspiration for you, or what lessons did you learn from those groups?
Oh, very definitely, very definitely. I remember José Bové, who was the head of the Confédération Paysanne, and I was really impressed when the Confédération Paysanne and José Bové organised to demolish a McDonald's that was being built in Millau in the south of France, and they announced to the police that they were going to do it, collected all the farmers around and drove into town with tractors and diggers and pulled a McDonald's down. They pulled it down because they didn't want to see the industrialisation and the McMurdization of French food. So there was a desire to stand up and make something happen. And that was a protest movement, but it was a protest movement supported by the solutions they were proposing to build a food sovereignty movement in Europe. And that was really impressive. The types of meetings they held were small group meetings, lots of argy-bargy and discussion, and then action followed. And it was generally very positive and influential.
That movement was led mostly by farmers. I mean, José Bové was a very famous farmer, small farmer. So French farmers are leading this movement. Why aren't New Zealand farmers doing similar? I can't imagine New Zealand farmers going and demolishing the McDonald's. Can you?
No. We do see in New Zealand that we're starting to see the rise of the regenerative farming movement. But the difference in Europe is that there are agricultural syndicates or unions. So there's the FNSEA, the Fédération Nationale des Syndicats d'Exploitation Agricole, I think. And then there's the Confédération Paysanne. And that's like federated farmers. And if there was a union of regenerative farmers, the Confédération Paysanne was much smaller, but really active and trying to build. Well, I mean, their catch cry was, another world is possible. And they tried to make it possible by supporting return to the earth movements, small-scale farming, organic farming, regenerative farming.
And France isn't the only country that has those movements. Those are very powerful farming movements in South America and across Europe and in Africa as well, if I remember correctly.
Yes, I think, you know, in all of the non-settler states, the countries where there has been an agriculture or an agriculture that has grown from the traditional roots, those movements, they've retained some sort of the peasant or the early agricultural values, and they've built those into structures. In New Zealand, in all the settler states, New Zealand, the US, Australia, they don't seem to have emerged to the same degree. We moved straight into the industrial agricultural model, and we don't understand that there is another model, or that there is a multitude of models.
So you started with food sovereignty because you did community food sovereignty because you did start working in that sort of area, but you quickly shifted to the focus on power.
Mm.
Why power?
Energy is what enables us to do more than simply survive. It enables us to thrive. And what has given us Western civilization has also caused the long emergency we're now in. And that's the proliferation and the conspicuous consumption of fossil fuels. So to provide and ensure that we can continue to prosper on this small blue planet, we need to move quickly off fossil fuels, and we need to move to other solutions. And those solutions have to be through renewables. So we have to use our existing carbon budget to build renewables now. And those renewables have to be efficient enough to deliver energy at a way that enables us to live with up or above subsistence level, enables us to maintain civilization. In my opinion, I think civilization has a lot of value, and I like reading. I like time to discuss ideas. Those are things you only get in civilization. In a subsistence society, you eat, you work, and you sleep. So we need to, in my opinion, try and do better than that, and we can.
So I like reading too, and I enjoyed today reading some of the things you've written. You've written quite a lot. One of the sentences was, challenges of democratizing our electricity sector through small-scale renewable generation in a carbon-constrained world. What's democratizing our electricity sector mean?
Democratizing our electricity sector is about flax roots, ownership, control, and management of energy resources. So it's ensuring that we're not subject to, or we're not dependent on the lords, the energy overrulers. We can determine our own fate, and we can do so through ownership of smart grids, development of energy resources that can be incorporated into community scale distribution systems, owning our own solar panels, wind turbines, etc.
Because the next question is the renewal generations are is obvious, and the carbon-constrained world is obvious. The scale is a question. And the scale that you're developing at, New Zealand's largely renewable anyway.
No.
No? In terms of electricity,
it's largely renewable. And where it's not largely renewable, it's definitely not renewable. And that's a choice we make. So we don't have to have 20% or 15% of our electricity powered by coal, but we choose to. And we don't have to drive cars powered by petrol, but we choose to. We don't have to travel in cars, but we choose to because we choose not to have public transport at an adequate level at an affordable price for everyone to be able to have access.
You spent a very long time trying to build a turbine. What have you learnt from that?
I've learnt that sometimes I've learnt, I guess, that regulations need to change, and that no matter how clear the evidence is, there are still people who refuse to see it or to read it or to understand it, and that opinions are very hard to shift, and facts don't shift opinions.
Because I love the fact that the Polytech's got a turbine on the roof of D Block, and I love the fact that it goes like the clappers and it's hardly producing any electricity. And you think, why do we bother? You think, hang on, that's how much work we're having to do to produce the electricity that we're just wasting. I think it's a perfect talking point. And the connection that you could have had with, oh, it's blowing a lot today, it's okay to do the drying today, or it's okay to charge the car.
Well, that's exactly right. And when we were working through the community engagement on building a small wind farm, so we initially wanted to build 3 wind turbines on Porteous Hill above Blueskin Bay, one of the people who spoke to us said, you know what I'd like? I'd like a set of traffic lights in my kitchen, and it would shine green when the wind turbines were turning. Then I'd know that it was a good time to put the dishwasher on, to put the washing machine on and everything. And I could look out the window as well, but, you know, if it shone green, I would know I could power the house. And when it went to orange or red, I would know that I should turn things off. And it's that connection with our energy that we really wanted to create, and that a good number of residents wanted to see. They wanted to be able to see what was happening and understand that there is a cost to our profligate use of energy, and we can't just push that onto others. We have to accept it and embrace it. And there are some people like me who see wind turbines as kinetic, beautiful kinetic sculptures, and others see them as scars on the landscape.
They're scars on the landscape if they are just an alternative for industrialized overconsumption, that we haven't actually addressed our relationship with energy, if it's just we can just produce more. Then we start to think, hang on, you know, eventually we'll run out of places to put them, and you still haven't addressed the real problem.
Yes, yeah. Well, I think, you know, we will see many more wind turbines in New Zealand. That's inevitable. The Productivity Commission's report 2 years ago, talks about a massive build of wind power in New Zealand because we have no more river valleys to flood, and because solar will expand but can't actually do it, and geothermal can expand a bit, but really the big gains will be made by wind power. And for that reason, it makes sense to try and democratise our system, for us to not be held hostage to the big boys and girls, to develop our own assets, and to have them embedded within local grids as a way of building resilience, so that if there is the big one, if the high voltage direct current link between the North and South Island is cut by a massive earthquake and the grid goes down, we can reboot from the various small-scale generation embedded in local grids.
So one of the things you've been focusing on is the smart grid marketplace, the community smart grid marketplace.
Yes, that's the Blueskin Energy Network is a peer-to-peer electricity sharing retail service. So we enable people who have an excess of electricity to share it within the local network or to balance it using smart grids with consumption that is in within the local network. And this is a community commercial partnership. The Blueskin Energy Limited is partnered with EMH Trade, a tier one market participant, if you like. That means that they are a company that is allowed to trade on the electricity market. We're not. And they provide the service and the smarts, the smart algorithms to make that work. And with that comes a clever app that enables us to see when the best time is to use electricity. So we can have squeaky clean green electricity, or we can have the dirty coal-fired electricity.
So the school has got solar panels all over it now. Looks fabulous.
Waitati School, 10 kilowatts of solar panels, 11.5 if we count the Blueskin Trust office. I can't tell you exactly how much they use. I don't.
But they're contributing to the smart grid.
They are contributing significantly to the smart grid.
And so rather than just selling it back to the grid at the wholesale rate or whatever it's called, there's people in your area who say, I'm prepared to buy that.
That's right. So, and the school's excess was sold primarily to, and is sold primarily to, those members of the Blueskin Energy Network who are also part of the school community. So they get their electricity, their power. It's all the same power. Electrons don't have a colour or a taste or a flavour, but we can measure it with smart meters. And so they get that power at 6 cents cheaper than grid power, the power that comes off the grid, which is significantly cheaper. And the school gets twice as much than it would if it was selling just into the grid. So it gets an extra benefit. And I was told that the school's power bill for the month of January was $50 this year. Now, that's a significant reduction on the power bill that it had before it had solar panels and before it joined the Blueskin Energy Network. And that means that the money that it's not spending on energy, it's spending on education.
So what the premise of transition towns is just living a better life, getting on with being positive. Is that an important part of what you're working on? Is that we don't have to convince everyone. Let's just get on with living a better life.
Exactly. I think if we wait for everyone to agree, we'll die. People don't agree. We're people. But we still need to do things. And I'm more engaged or more enthusiastic about providing solutions and working on solutions. It's something that makes me happy, gives me endorphins, when we can do something and make something real rather than complaining about our lot. That's not to say that we shouldn't try and stop the bad things, but we mustn't forget that there are solutions that we can provide at the same time. So we've got to do both. We've got to stop consuming fossil fuels and provide the alternatives.
In the Our City, Our Climate report that you wrote last year, year before, there's a whole section about acting despite uncertainty. How do we just do that? Is it just a matter of doing it?
It's not just a matter of doing it blindly. I think it's a matter of not being afraid of not knowing everything. Sometimes there's a benefit in naivety and in trying something, but it's doing your best to understand or to appraise a situation and then giving it a go. And you might make a mistake, but we learn from our mistakes. We learn how to do things better, and we learn, or other people don't have to make that mistake if we've made it. So that's really what I think we've got to do. We know that things aren't fixed. We know that we're in a crisis of long duration, and that we are going to have to change things, but we don't know how, and we don't know what the best solution is, and we don't know how to do it. So we've got to try everything right now. We've got to try everything.
You, one of the things you started out doing was putting in insulation. Recently you told me that you've been putting up chipboard. So you're actively doing this stuff as well. This is not just ordering other people about.
Yes, oh, if only I could order other people about.
So you've been working on the Climate Safe House. What's that?
The Climate Safe House is an adaptable, affordable, transportable, modular eco home. It's designed to be a template for how we might provide for both for the combined housing and climate crisis. And it is built well above spec, so it's a better build using new technologies. Well, using old technologies, but well above building code and outside of the building code. It's an alternative solution. And it uses SIPS panels, structural insulated panels, which do have a carbon component to it, to them, but they provide a very, very complete thermal envelope for the house. So they provide insulation for the floor, the walls, and the ceiling. And the holes in the walls, the doors and the windows, are filled in with UPVC and Metro glass double glazed windows, which are naturally thermally broken because they're UPVC, and it provides for a very, very warm dwelling, and a dwelling that can remain cool in hot climate as well because it's so well insulated.
And is the, in addition to all of that, is there an element of what's the transportable element? Is it that we can get it out of the way if this area starts to flood?
Yes, so any house that's built on stilts can be picked up and taken away. But we've got to be honest about that. But this house is a little bit different. It's built like a light brick shit house. It's so bloody solid that you could pick it up and move it and the windows won't warp, the doors won't warp, and you can put it down somewhere else, you could roll it down a hill and it would still be fine. So it's designed to be picked up again and shifted, and it will be in the future because the flooding will become so extreme. So it will have another life, a second life, possibly a third life. It's also designed, even though it's in a low wind zone, to withstand high wind zone. It's got its own energy system, and it's got its own waste system. So those things, they're like the clip-ons, but they provide a house that is able to withstand a whole lot of different scenarios. Not everything, but the lights aren't going to go out when the grid goes down.
And you said you were doing it partly because you've now got a house that people can live in, but also as a signal for what's possible. Is it getting noticed?
Yes, yes. We have had great media coverage and a lot of interest from policymakers, from government. So we had a fantastic opening with Marama Davidson and our mayor, Aaron Hawkins, with Anthony Deka Naitahu. And that was a really fantastic celebration of what we managed to achieve with all our partners, all the contributions from all the sponsors, the donors, the people who've worked long hours to make it real. And it was a great way to cap it off. We didn't have any champagne because we didn't want to break anything against that house. But it's something that we hope will be taken up and used, particularly when we start to address the housing issues in Dunedin.
And how much would it does it cost compared to like a standard house that's built here?
It's hard to give a precise figure because it was a pilot. It's a pilot, and so there are one-off costs that we would never have again. For example, we wouldn't typically do as we did that time and get components delivered to the Forsyth Barr Stadium, build the basic structure at the Forsyth Barr Stadium, then transport it to site to complete it off-site. We would simply build it on-site. So you've got those extra costs of trucking it to one site, trucking it to another, craning it onto site, etc. And then you've got all the discovery costs, all the little extra costs that when you're doing something the first time aren't there the second time. It's insured for $300,000. We estimate that this house will probably cost around $4,000 a square meter, or somewhere around $2,500 for a 60 square meter home when we start doing it at scale. And that includes everything. That includes the structure, the carpet, the timber, the marmoleum, the appliances, the energy system, the waste system, everything bar the curtains.
That's quite a good price, you know, for people who don't aren't in the know. But that's a very good price for that, you know, to deliver a house like that.
The most, what's not explicit in that price is that it has, we anticipate it has zero energy bill. So that's, if you think about lifetime cost, it's very cheap to build a legal house that performs very, very poorly, and it will cost you a fortune over its lifetime. And yet it costs almost as much to build that as it does to build a climate-safe house. So we think that when people understand the lifetime cost, and when they start valuing the quality of life you can have in a warm and cozy home built to be comfortable, then that little bit extra, with its extra value for resale and for insurability, is a real selling point. It should be what we build.
Okay, I've got some questions to end with, and we've got only 4 minutes to get through them, so we're going to have to really rattle. Do you have a go-to definition of sustainability?
I prefer resilience to sustainability. Sustainability is a bit of a catch-all, and it's been used and abused. So resilience is about the ability to bounce back from...
I think I prefer regeneration to resilience.
Adverse, yes, I could understand why, but yeah.
What's the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
We've had two. We've established the Blueskin Energy Network, and we've just completed construction of the Climate Safe House.
We're writing a book of these conversations. We're calling it Tomorrow's Heroes. What's your superpower? You're in the mansion. And we want a real one, not laser eyes.
Tenacity.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
No. Not an activist, someone who's purely active.
Purely active. What motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
The children I have and grandchildren I may have, if we're lucky, the beautiful bird song, and the desire to make something good happen today.
What challenges are you looking forward to in the next couple of years?
I want to see some good green change in our political environment, and I'm looking forward to stepping up if needed.
If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur, what would you have happen?
I would have all the carbon that we have emitted in the last 300 years sequestered immediately.
Can we do anything to make that happen?
We can't do carbon capture. But we can reduce our emissions through supporting public transport, through supporting renewables, through supporting local food, and through consuming less.
And lastly, and you've got a minute to do this, do you have any advice for our listeners?
I would say that there's always something we can do, and never underestimate the power of example, but don't feel burdened by doing everything right all the time. So giving it a go, whether it is cycling to work, using public transport, sharing a ride, growing some more food or some food in your backyard, voting, volunteering for a community organisation, sharing a difficult conversation with a relative, any of those things is really important and can make a difference. And we need to consider our role as an important role in building a better society.
All right, thank you. You're listening to Sustainable Lens on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM. This show was recorded on the 27th of February, 2020. Our guest was Scott Willis. Your hosts were Professor Samuel Mann and me, Shane Montague Gallagher. You can get podcasts of previous shows on sustainablelens.org, where you can subscribe on iTunes or on orir.org.nz. We hope you enjoyed the show.
Take ORFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and streaming of primo local content. Download the accessmedia.nz app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This program was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.